Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Teddy Roosevelt was the original Republican warrior maverick, and a century ago, he burned with a reforming righteousness like few presidents in American history.
We stand at Armageddon, and we battle for the Lord.
Now a new Republican warrior is on the stump, and T.R. is his guiding light. Here's John McCain.
Theodore Roosevelt, obviously, is my ultimate hero.
Teddy Roosevelt took on big business in Washington and anyone who wanted to fight globally with his big stick foreign policy. McCain loves TR. This hour On Point, we'll look at the ideas, some surprising, that drove Teddy Roosevelt and how they play today in the McCain campaign. Joining me now from the NPR studios in Washington is Joshua Hawley. He's a young scholar who's just out with a new history of the ideas that drove Theodore Roosevelt. It's called Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. At 28, he also just happens to be a young lawyer clerking to Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts. Josh Hawley, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. He's also author of Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900, a history of the years leading up to Teddy Roosevelt's presidency. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom, and hello, Joshua.
Hi.
Josh, we're going to talk about politics today, but take us to politics then first, and the sort of basic framework for Teddy Roosevelt's thinking about the world. Was this McCain circa 1900?
Well, Senator McCain can certainly sound a lot like then-President Roosevelt. President Roosevelt came to office in a nation that was roiled by social and economic change in the midst of a major immigration boom, seeing patterns of living across the country changing in ways that the country really hadn't seen in more than a century. The effect of this was to produce a serious sense of discontent in the country that Roosevelt sought to answer. And in fact, I was struck recently reading a piece from the Atlantic Monthly, of all magazines, in 1879. The title of a piece, a little essay, was called A Moral Interregnum, and the author suggests as early as 1879 that the collapse of the moral consensus of the 19th century, meaning mostly organized Christianity and the series of beliefs that went along with that, had produced a moral interregnum in the country. And that, combined with the shifting economic system and the country's changing demographic patterns, was unsettling the country to such a great degree that people felt not only economically uncertain, but also morally uncertain, uncertain socially about the future of the country. Roosevelt's presidency blossomed in this period, and in many ways his politics was a response to that moral, social, and economic discontent.
You write a lot about Teddy Roosevelt's righteousness. George Will today complains about, or recently complains about, John McCain's towering moral vanity. We'll set that aside for a moment. But Teddy Roosevelt's righteousness, it wasn't exactly classical Christian or evangelical righteousness like we've seen more recently. There was a different flavor to it. How would you describe, Josh, the fundamental ideas that drove this man, this politician?
I would say that at the core of Roosevelt's political ideas was the notion that democracy is a fundamentally moral undertaking. He thought that democracy depended on the good character of its citizens, that is to practice self-government, to sustain democratic government. Citizens had to become good people. But by good people, he meant people who were able to practice the civic virtues. For instance, he told a group in South Carolina in 1905 that only those communities who are able to practice the virtues of self-command, self-restraint, and wise disinterestedness are fit for self-government. So his vision of righteousness was a fundamentally civic vision, but it was very central to his thought. Democracy required citizens to become good people. And this is essentially Republican with a lowercase r. Republican vision has roots in America's history, stretching back, in fact, to English history, and maybe all the way back to the Greek city-state. Interestingly, It also has roots in Roosevelt's personal history and his upbringing, particularly the lessons and inspiration of his father, as well as in his religion. But you're quite right, the righteousness that he practiced and preached has a somewhat different tone and was aiming at something different than the religious versions that we hear today. It was a fundamentally political concept. These were political sermons that he was preaching.
We think of Teddy Roosevelt, and he intended us to, as a man of action, charging up San Juan Hill, Rough Riders, and all that. His friend Henry Miller famously called him pure act, as in action. But what about the imprint that he left in taking on the trusts, the big corporations of that day, in his sense of what the presidency ought to be, in his sense of what government could and should do, Josh? What stays with us today? What was the legacy he left in terms of policy?
One of the legacies that he left, and probably the most significant one, is the institutional rearrangement of American government, and particularly the American presidency, by which I mean the administrative state, as we know it today, really had its genesis in the Roosevelt presidency. Now, certainly not to the size and degree that is familiar to us, but nevertheless, Roosevelt was a great believer in professional administrative bureaucracy. And if possible, professional administration located in the executive branch, responsible to the president. We refer to it as the administrative state. He probably would have called it the presidential state. But he was a firm advocate of this, partly because he thought that the administrative state, professional administrators, would break the power of boss politics, bossism, he sometimes called it, and would break the link between local bosses, business interests, and Congress. And so he proposed an administrative state, again, located in and responsive to the presidency as a solution to interest group politics. So the rise of the administrative state is really one of his greatest institutional legacies. Another is his conception of the presidency as an American icon, as a public figure, the president as celebrity. Roosevelt was the first president regularly to campaign for legislation. He went out in 1905 and 1906 on a nationwide speaking tour pushing for his railroad rate regulation. That was a significant break with past practice. No president had done that before to such a degree and in such a sustained fashion. In fact, he's the one who coined the phrase or the expression appealing over the heads of Congress to the people, which we hear very regularly now. Ronald Reagan used to invoke that all the time. Well, that's a Roosevelt idea. That's a Roosevelt practice. And that's something that he gave the country as well.
Went after the trusts, championed the working stiff, loved presidential power, and as you say, went right over the heads of Congress with it, coined the word muckraker, father of the Pure Food and Drug and Meat Inspection Act, speaking to that administrative state you were talking to. Of course, very prominent on the conservation and environmental front for his time, and of course, the big stick foreign policy, seized the Panama Canal Zone, got in the middle of the Russo-Japanese War, wasn't afraid to rattle sabers. Jack Beatty, how do you see the footprints of this man? We'll turn to John McCain, but here's Teddy Roosevelt first.
Well, you know, I think, Josh, you really do fill a void here. I mean, Roosevelt's personality and doings have commanded center stage for generations of biographers. How could they not? What a fabulous, many-sided character. But the other part of him, the serious part, the intellectual part, his thought, that's been scanted. And so I really think you do a great service in bringing that forward and presenting it as in some sense, a coherent a picture, a response to the world, rather than simply a series of opportunistic gestures, as some historians have done. Yet what I'm struck with, Josh, is how unattractive so much of this thought is. You speak of his dark vision, and it's almost as if it's easier to reach back to the personality and the doings than it is to the thinking, which is so alien to us.
I think that that's right. And what makes Roosevelt's vision dark in many respects is his racialism. And happily, that is something that has been forgotten. Happily for him, it is typically passed over in his public persona today. But it's very difficult to take Roosevelt as a thinker without exploring his racialist ideas, which were rooted in his devotion to the concept of evolution, but expanded significantly out from that to the concept of races. Nations, he thought, were races. And one of the more interesting and unfortunate moves Roosevelt makes intellectually is to take the old civic Republican tradition emphasizing the need for civic virtue to sustain a democracy, good qualities of character. He takes that and he gives it a racial twist. He racializes the virtues. So they, in Roosevelt's hands, the virtues necessary to promote democracy become things like virility and hardihood, essentially racial virtues that he thought could be passed on racially, biologically.
And that he placed in a particular race, in white Americans and I guess white American WASPs.
Yes, absolutely. Was very concerned towards the end of his presidency and the end of his public career, especially about the decline of the WASP class, his class, in the Northeast, and castigated them for not having children in sufficient numbers. For the real Americans, he said, were dying off, and he found this to be a significant problem. That's the, to speak to your point, Jack, that's the dark side of Roosevelt's politics, and the loss of those racial politics is surely nothing to lament.
Name McKinley's two they traduced, and they wouldn't you trust them? I will not, will you? Roosevelt the cry. Let that Democrat named Hill all his evil venom spill, yet he'll taste a bitter pill. Roosevelt the cry.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, historical hero to John McCain. And the ideas that drove him, my guest is Joshua Hawley. He's author of the new History of Teddy Roosevelt's Thinking, his ideas. It's called Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. It comes out this month. He also happens to be clerk to, John Hawley does, to John Roberts, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's listen back to Teddy Roosevelt for just a moment here. Here he is in New York City, July 13th, 1913, delivering an address to the Boys Progressive League.
The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically, a square deal in matters social and industrial.
A square deal for every man and woman in the United States, and that's language that might work pretty well today when some people wonder if things are out of square, a little skewed. Here's Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 speaking to a New York audience about his relationship with conservatives, which, like John McCain's, was not exactly simple or easy.
I am not leading this fight as a matter of aesthetic pleasure. I am leading because somebody must lead, or else the fight would not be made at all. I prefer to work with moderate, with rational conservatives, provided only that they do in good faith strive forward toward the light. But when they halt and turn their backs to the light, sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them.
And here's John McCain himself in an NPR interview earlier this year telling Michelle Norris about his love of Teddy Roosevelt.
I happen to be particularly fond of T.R.
That's Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt. He had the vision of the greatness of America in the 20th century. He, a man of incredible energy and exuberance, and I thought he was just one of the great leaders.
He talks him up. He talked him up big time in 2000. In 2008, he's talking a little more about Ronald Reagan. There seems to be a real question whether you can be a big fan of both, of each simultaneously in the GOP at the same time. Josh Hawley, I wish you'd dwell for a moment on circumstances then and now that might make a Teddy Roosevelt message relevant again today in 2008. It seems remarkable that it might be 100 years and more after he was out campaigning for votes in this country, but John McCain picks him up. Why do you think this might be a useful icon for a candidate again today?
Roosevelt addressed with his presidency this sense of moral and social discontent that we talked about earlier, and I'm struck by the way he defined what it meant to be a progressive. He said in 1912 in his famous speech to the Progressive Convention that we want to use government as an efficient agency for the practical betterment of social and economic conditions, and all of that for the moral health of the nation and the preservation of self-government. I think that message, that politics can be used, that government can be used to better Americans' lives and to help Americans better themselves and improve their world, is something that is the country is hungry for. You see that not just in the success of the McCain candidacy in the Republican primaries, but also in the, I think, the great interest in Barack Obama's candidacy on the Democratic side. So to a certain extent, I think that the same sense of moral and social dislocation that was so prominent in the early 20th century is also prominent, perhaps in a slightly different way, in the early 21st century. And I mentioned the moral interregnum piece from the Atlantic Monthly that I thought captured so nicely the spirit of the early 20th century. I wonder now if what we're seeing is not just a frustration and fatigue with the politics of the last 20 or 30 years, though certainly we are seeing that, but if really this campaign cycle is demonstrating a fatigue with the politics of the last 60 or 70 years. And we can talk a bit more about that if you like. But in some ways, when Theodore Roosevelt lost to Woodrow Wilson in 1912, it was not just the end of Roosevelt's political career effectively. It was the beginning of a new era in American politics. And I think it's just possible that that era is coming to a close now, and that explains the hunger for a fresh, new, even, dare I say it, transformational politics that we see today.
We're talking very big waves there of history and politics. We'll come and look further at that, but I want to set the table just a little further. Jack, your book Age of Betrayal came out not long ago. It looks in particular at how Americans a century ago had grown weary, and Teddy Roosevelt picked up on this like gangbusters, had grown weary of the special power that had flowed to Americans of great wealth.
Indeed, he was in some ways the antidote to the Gilded Age, and one of his achievements was the signing in 1907 of an act, a Tillman Act, that banned direct corporate contributions and union contributions, for that matter, to political campaigns. That was a response to what the progressives saw as the besetting sin of the Gilded Age, the unholy alliance, as I think Roosevelt put it, between business and government. And there's some irony here. That was in 1907. In 2007. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a provision of the McCain-Feingold Act. It's a complicated business that Josh can explain, but according to David Souter in his dissent, effectively, this had opened up the door, if only a crack, to corporate contributions coming back in. And Souter said, here we are. In 100 years, we've come full circle. And the author of the opinion that did strike down this McCain-Feingold ruling was none other than Justice Roberts.
There you go. We'll come to that, Josh Hawley. That's in your current neck of the woods. Here's Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. Out of the GOP, accepting the Bull Moose nomination and talking about exactly that unholy alliance.
To dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics is the first task of the statesmanship of the day.
There he was. He'd been at it for some years. He was president from 1901 to 1909. In 1912, he felt he still hadn't done it, Josh? Dissolve that unholy alliance?
He worse than that, he thought that his party had fallen prey to the unholy alliance, had been co-opted, if you like. And in one of the earlier pieces that we listened to, you heard Roosevelt say that if I don't lead the fight, no one will. That's sort of his personal hubris there at work, as well as his political ideas. He was convinced that William Howard Taft, his chosen successor, I might add, handpicked, had failed to carry on his progressive mantle and enact the progressive policy. politics, practice the progressive politics that Roosevelt preached. And so in 1912, you saw him campaigning not just against the Unholy Alliance, but against his own party. He decided that if the party wasn't with him, then he was no longer for the Republican Party. And so it was quite a campaign, and it was a very momentous year for the country.
When we hear all the talk about lobbyists' influence in Washington today, does that sound to you like a century later parallel to the to his bemoaning the influence of malefactors of great wealth?
Absolutely. I think that the entire reformist strain that you hear from John McCain and other presidential candidates is probably the closest analog, contemporary analog, to Roosevelt's own rhetoric. This notion that Washington is beset by special interests, is captivated by people and controlled by people who are more interested in exercising power than in actually accomplishing anything for the public. This sounds very much like Theodore Roosevelt. Indeed, some of the rhetoric coming from the right, the skepticism or frustration with the court system and with the federal courts in particular, also sounds like Roosevelt, who as a progressive was very irritated with the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court in particular. So I think that there are a number of very fascinating parallels there.
Josh Hawley's new book is Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. Josh, a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. Let me turn to them. Mark is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is very interesting. It seems to me that the coming elections, the general election, is almost going to be the opposite of 2004. Instead of, you know, rallying the base, I think it's going to be a fight for independence. I think much less divisive, and I think that I think McCain is not going to at all pander to conservatives. I think that he'll probably leave that to third parties and surrogates and Swift voters, and that the populism of Teddy Roosevelt's positions is sort of an ideal place to go with that.
So John McCain may want to stay right on that theme. Mark, let me put it to Jack and Josh. Jack, Mark sees no need maybe for John McCain to, as he puts it, pander to conservatives this time. Do you think John McCain is holding the Teddy Roosevelt beacon firmly in the center of his sights, Jack?
Well, I think that Roosevelt, Josh would know more about this, but he very ably identified sort of the independent voter, what we would call that today, the mugwump, the voter who was not rallying to the partisanship, but to the special interests in either party, and he targeted that voter and spoke for that voter. And I think in this campaign, what do we see? John McCain has a history of speaking to that voter, and that was one of his one of his qualifications to run for president. I can appeal to that voter. And Barack Obama, his whole raison d'etre is I appeal to the independent voter who's disgusted with the interest group politics of the parties and wants a wider, bigger politics. So I think the both candidates are going to go after that independent.
But Jack,
voter.
Here we've got New York Times today saying, you know, McCain has been inconsistent on exactly some of these issues. He voted very unusually for a Republican against George Bush's tax cuts. He said, I just thought it was too tilted to the wealthy, and I still do. He voted twice against them. And now when the chips are down in the 08 campaign, Josh, he's saying, no, he would vote to extend those tax cuts. Do you see McCain kind of trimming his TR-style progressivism, if that's the right thing to call it?
What I see is a Republican Party orthodoxy that's in flux, and I think John McCain represents that and is reflecting it to some degree. And one of the things that McCain can learn most from Theodore Roosevelt, can take from him, is Roosevelt's political creativity. Roosevelt also confronted a party base, if you like, that was in some state of flux. So, you know, Mark mentioned appealing to the base versus appealing to independents. I think the question McCain has to confront is, what is the base? What is it mean to be be a Republican in the early 21st century? What are our priorities, and how are we justifying our policies? And you see this variation in Republican priorities and ideology. You've got one wing of the party, the Michael Gerson wing. This is Bush's former speechwriter, who emphasizes a sort of social improvement, social betterment. Mike Huckabee in some way represents this, a focus on the poor, a focus on those less fortunate, lower working class Americans. Then you have the business interests, the Wall Street Journal, Club for Growth sort of group of the party, who are focused on economic efficiency. You have all of these different strands of Republicanism that are competing now to define the party. And what Roosevelt did, facing a similar situation, is say, well, let's make the market, let's use government to help structure the market to make it work for democracy. Let's make our markets work to promote in citizens the qualities of character that help citizens succeed, and let's use government as a way to structure the market so that it will actually do good for the country and be a prop to democracy rather than a detriment to it. So I think that the creativity that Roosevelt showed in redefining Republican orthodoxy is something that McCain has the opportunity to do as well. It's a daunting task,
but rubs right up against the Ronald Reagan message of government is the problem. Bruce is calling from Solon, Iowa. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Great show. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I would like to talk for a minute about the way that Roosevelt, T.R., packaged himself to be the president and sort of how it seemed to convert into a really muscular foreign policy. If you look at pictures of him, you see him in buckskins. You see him showing off his muscles as a scholar at Harvard. You see him riding his horse out west where he lived. You see political cartoonists getting on board with showing him strangling a Colombian dictator as he went for the Panama Canal. You
yep.
see him squeezing, and so on and so forth. So I this, I think, led naturally to, or led also to a very muscular foreign policy, obviously enough. And I think that the muscular foreign policy, in turn, went right through, continued right through Woodrow Wilson, continued through Republican and Democratic administrations, including Roosevelt and so on and so forth. All that to say, I'm wondering how your guests see this sort of muscular foreign policy in John McCain, and this kind of constant requirement that the United States apparently has to exert itself globally, when it often leads to disasters, both as we can see right now, both for the country and for the countries where we've gotten too involved.
Bruce, a great angle, and I'm glad you raised it so well. Josh Hawley, first take us right to the history. Teddy Roosevelt, just as muscular and maybe even macho a foreign policy as you can imagine. I mean, let's just call it what straight up imperialism, really. Remind us of the bones of that.
Roosevelt thought that the America needed to project its power around the world for the good of the world, and this comes back to, in part, to the racialism that we were discussing earlier. He thought that the United States represented the vanguard of the white Anglo-Saxon English race, and that by projecting American power around the world, including, in fact, colonizing or governing colonies, the United States would be spreading freedom. How so? Because it would spread the institutions that made for democratic liberty. So that was sort of the thinking that inspired much of his foreign policy. Now, having said that, he was a skillful practitioner and astute observer of the balance of power. So his rhetoric was often far more strident than his actual policies and practice as president. He mediated the Russo-Japanese War. Even his sending of the fleet around the world was, in some respects, a careful sort of strategic ploy. So Henry Kissinger, I'm struck, has said in print that he thinks Theodore Roosevelt was one of, if not the most astute practitioner of realpolitik ever to be president. So there's an interesting tension there, and I think that Bruce has successfully identified the strident nature of Roosevelt's rhetoric, how he, in fact, conducted himself and how he would conduct our foreign policy adventures today, I think, is a different question.
Jack, we've just got a second here, but it would be an easy theme to keep a neocon tune going with when
sure
that seems
would.
Out of favor.
It sure would, and I think Bruce raises the question Josh touched on it earlier. You know, is this election about something bigger than just these 4 years? Or is it about some change, some fundamental change? And many of us would hope it's a change from this. from this muscular foreign policy more to Lincoln's idea, which is rather than conquer the world or terrify it, we should be an example to it, that that's the American way of leading.
While everybody was jumping around, all you could hear was that boom, boom sound.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about T.R. Teddy Roosevelt, historical hero to John McCain, and the ideas that drove him. My guest is Joshua Hawley. His new history of T.R.'s ideas is Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness, comes out this month. Hawley is a clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. Sam is calling from Harwich, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And I think when, Tom, you mentioned the word imperialism, it really kind of caught my imagination. I think the whole McCain-Teddy Roosevelt connection is kind of hilarious in a sense. I mean, it just seems so out of touch with where we need to go as not only as a country but as a world, because it seems that both Roosevelt and McCain really kind of believe in the superiority of the American race. And that's why we're in the trouble that we're in today. And with issues like the Iraq War and global warming, I think it's just the old ideas are just completely out of touch. And I think the real point that I've always been fascinated about McCain is how he's going to square his vote in Iraq with anything that's going to be new, because it's hard to spin that in any other way except this was a war about U.S. imperialism to secure oil interests. And it's kind of hard, if you look at the issue with any care, to see it any other way. And I'd be interested to hear your guests' take on that.
Sam, thanks very much for that. Josh Hawley, how about it? Here we have in John McCain, yes, POW war hero, also the son and grandson of four-star Navy admirals, very much in the military tradition of the United States. That reaches in a father and grandfather way back in history in a hurry. So does all this seem like a on the sort of power projection, national greatness side, we'll battle for 100 years in Iraq if necessary? Does this seem, the TR references in McCain's mouth, do they seem current on this front to you or outdated, wrong focus?
Well, it depends on how he invokes Roosevelt and for what purposes. I think that if he invokes Roosevelt as an example of someone who called the nation to live better, to do more, to be better, and to strive for the common good. I mean, Roosevelt consistently and unabashedly called American citizens to sacrifice their self-interest, to serve their countrymen, and to serve their country. And to join him in the cause of reform. And that meant social reform, it meant economic reform, it meant political reform. I think that message does resonate. I think that is a powerful message that you hear both candidates, or all candidates, I should say, all three of them right now, attempting to tap, and I think one that would be very salient in the general election. As far as Roosevelt's foreign policy, I'm struck that we talked just a bit ago about his rhetoric and his image, which could be quite strident. Roosevelt also, though, proposed an international alliance of which the United States would be part. He didn't particularly like Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations because he thought it wouldn't work. But he proposed what he called, in characteristic fashion, a World League for Righteousness. Mm-hmm. But the idea was a league of states, something that actually looks very much like NATO today, that the United States would be part of. So Roosevelt was no unilateralist in the sense of, let's just go it alone. And I've heard John McCain actually refer recently to Roosevelt's proposal for a World League of Righteousness and say that he's very interested in the concept and thinks it could be a useful foreign policy measure. So I think that there are some more interesting parallels on their foreign policy side haven't been fully developed yet. McCain hasn't talked about them a whole lot, but I'll be interested to see where he takes that. And I think that angle is a little bit different than the sort of imperial rhetoric that we often hear from Roosevelt and often hear or think of when Roosevelt's name is invoked on the foreign policy angle.
With the great white fleet sent around the world and the Philippines taken over, et cetera, let's go to Buffalo and Alice in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Buffalo is the home of the Theodore Roosevelt inaugural site. I think they had to find him in the woods somewhere and bring him here as vice president after the assassination. I think Barack Obama more truly represents the finer attitude of Theodore Roosevelt. And if we were to elect him president, it would show how far this country has come. Thank you.
So you see, Obama more in those shoes. Theodore Roosevelt, of course, inaugurated after McKinley's assassination.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. His site is right around the corner from where I live.
Right.
And gets a lot of attention.
Josh Hawley, how about it? If there's a battle here for the mantle, and I don't know if there is, but Obama versus McCain.
Obama has talked a lot about a transformative politics. Now, I think that's a very Rooseveltian notion, and it is something that maybe this country is ready for. Now, I'm not sure that John McCain has necessarily abandoned that or isn't going to talk about it. I think both candidates might be vying for that style of politics. But to the degree that Obama has emphasized, even his yes, we can improve the country, yes, we can improve ourselves. You know, I'm struck by this. He's taken a lot of flack for this line, we are the change that we've been waiting for. I'm not sure what he means by that. But I think there are certain Roosevelt parallels there. And the parallel would be something like social change starts with personal change. I mean, Roosevelt believed in social transformation through the power of individuals improving their own lives and then acting together to improve their communities and to improve their nation. That is, Obama has been sounding those themes now for months, and I think that has a lot to do with his success, and that sounds a heck of a lot like Theodore Roosevelt. So I'll be interested to see how this plays out, but that goes back, I think, to the point I was trying to make earlier, that in some ways, the politics that have been ascendant really since 1912 and certainly since the 1930s, a politics of personal autonomy, a politics emphasizing personal liberty, where liberty is conceived as sort of non-interference, don't interfere in my life, leave me alone, that sort of thing. I think the country is in many ways exhausted with that politics, tired and bored with it. And this election represents a search for something new.
Jack, that sounds to me like a 28-year-old speaking, and Josh may be right, but do you see, Jack, the Republican Party, after all these decades of personal autonomy and individual liberty as being the kind of be-all and end-all of Republican priorities, do you see the GOP is tired of that theme?
Well, I mean, they have been. Aspects of their coalition, the moral, the evangelical Christian strain of the Republicans, have been saying for years that the government should, you know, remoralize us, and we need to strike down Roe v. Wade and other such liberal,
yeah.
Individual
freedom guarantees.
Right, right. But, you know, when I hear this talk, I'm stirred by it, as everyone is, and yet at the same time, the 19th century liberal in me says, wait a minute. Do I really want government to be involved in moral enterprises? Do I really want to be improved in some way by government? Isn't it enough that it be competent? Isn't it enough that it, you know, have a certain level of social justice and a playing field and so on, but leave these high notes to other parts of life? In other words, there's a kind of statism in this call for, you know, moral regeneration through politics that in other countries, it hasn't been a very happy dynamic, and I'm a little chary of that, I must say, in McCain and perhaps even in Obama.
Josh Hawley, how about it? Now Jack Beatty's sounding like a more recent Republican, but maybe a 19th century liberal here.
And that was exactly the series of arguments that Jack has just rehearsed there that Woodrow Wilson so very successfully leveled at Theodore Roosevelt in 1912, and that is undoubtedly a very powerful strand in the American experience. And the critique, Wilson's critique of Roosevelt, was essentially that Roosevelt was a statist. And, you know, he was right in many ways, and that he also, Wilson's critique further, was that Roosevelt was dangerous to individual rights. He didn't appreciate the value of personal autonomy. He didn't appreciate the need for government restraint. In fact, Wilson said to Roosevelt, you're for big government. You're for big brother government. That Wilson was the one, a Democrat, who coined that phrase and used it so successfully against Roosevelt. So I think that in Roosevelt's politics of transformation, the way that he practiced them, they do tend towards statism. That is a dangerous tendency, I think, particularly combined with his racialism. And that is something that any candidate today who is seeking to use Roosevelt's politics, you learn something from them, is going to have to, as Jack said, be very, very wary of, and is going to have to think a little bit differently. The ways in which Roosevelt was willing to marshal state power, government power, to act directly on the populace is in some senses un-American, and continues even today, I think, to give Americans pause. That's something I think that again, his modern-day disciples or those who want to learn from him are going to have to think long and hard about.
Let's go to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
couple things here. I do object to the author's use of the term racialism to Teddy Roosevelt. Yes, there was some attitudes of that period, but also I understand that Teddy Roosevelt, unlike the president after him or two presidents after him, invited one of the most famous black authors of that day and age to the White House, and I think was very bothered by the reaction he got back. He got a very negative reaction from people to inviting that famous black author to the White House. There does seem to me to be a problem with the far right in this day and age that that they seem to like to call anybody on the liberal side racist in this day and age. So I have a problem with that use of that term.
David, well, let us pick that up. I mean, on the one hand, perhaps Teddy Roosevelt reached out on occasion. I'm not sure which author you're referring to. On the other hand, as I read Josh Hawley's history, racialism almost sounds like a euphemism or a favor to Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, by contemporary standards, when you just read what he has to say, it sounds more straight up racist and bigoted. I mean, here's one. He says, you know, he's sort of going for eugenics. Quoting Teddy Roosevelt, "I wish very much that the wrong people could be prevented entirely from breeding." Racialism seems like a soft phrase to describe that. But what do you say, Josh?
You know, it's the point's well taken that Roosevelt was very troubled by the rising tides of racism directed at African-American citizens in the South during his presidency and did some small things to attempt to combat it with his appointments and also with his public rhetoric. But having said that, you simply cannot be serious about Roosevelt's political thought without encountering and admitting the fact that he was consumed by this racialist philosophy, by the idea that races were a serious biological category, that much of life could be explained, and much of social life and political life could be explained by reference to races. He certainly thought that that the African race, including African Americans in this country, were lesser developed as a race. That was true of it. He thought the same thing of Native Americans and the same thing of any number of other races worldwide. He thought that the Anglo-American race or the English-speaking race was the superior race. And there just isn't any way around that. I wish there were. I think, a stain on Roosevelt's legacy and a serious problem for anyone attempting to appropriate or practice his politics today. But the truth is that was what Theodore Roosevelt thought, and unfortunately it drove a good bit of his politics.
Let's go to Linda in Beverly, Massachusetts. Linda, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for this program. It is yet another example of a wonderful forum with very knowledgeable guests and an opportunity to discuss the issues. And I do learn so much from your guests, but there are just a couple of things I would like to see you address.
Yes.
And I think you have already, in terms of the trust busting. And he was, if I remember correctly, it was railroad barons. And today, I think it translates to the oil barons. And what you have described, Mr. Hawley, is about some very liberal attitudes that, as you said, you reinforced the idea that they really reflect more Obama than they do the Republican Party. And it was my impression, as I studied history, that the Republican Party of Teddy Roosevelt's day is an entirely different party that does not translate to the current Republican Party. And even his racist views they are a part of the age in which he grew up and the family life in which he grew up.
Linda, our time is so short. Let us pick it up right there. And first, Jack, let me come to you, if I may, on this issue of what Teddy Roosevelt did and did not do in addressing corporate power of that time. And then, you know, is John McCain speaking in those terms today? He's often accused by Republicans of being unfriendly to business.
Well, Teddy was the trust buster, and Teddy, as I say, did sign the legislation banning corporate contributions to campaigns. He was a reformer. Reform meant keeping business out of politics. He wanted a square deal, which meant a better deal for the American worker. So in all these ways, he was a scourge of corporate power, and the old guard and the Republican Party didn't like him for that. I mean, the famous line was when he went to Africa, "We trust that some lion will do its duty." But with McCain, I think it's very difficult for him. I think his instincts are to go in that direction. He's hit at defense contractors and so on. But I think it's very hard to do within current Republican orthodoxy to take on corporate power that way. And his one effort, which I think was really quite distinctive and praiseworthy, the McCain-Feingold Act, is very unpopular with Republicans.
Josh, we've just got a minute here. On that front and on your bigger theme of a major sea change perhaps underway here, what do you see coming?
I think that it goes back to what sort of policies McCain advocates and why he's advocating them. And if he's advocating the policies as a way to call Americans to service, to self-sacrifice, to improve themselves and improve their world, I think that is a Roosevelt-style politics. And the specific policies that he advocates are not quite as important in the overall calculus as why he is advocating them. Now, having said that, I agree with Jack that I think that the challenge McCain faces, he has some very significant business interests that have been a longstanding part of the Republican coalition and have been very interested in the Republicans' traditional message of pro-economic growth. The challenge for him is, how do I keep that? How do I keep talking about economic growth, but how do I reorient it in such a way that this economic growth is about something more than serving our self-interest? And how do I do that in a sense that brings in a new generation of American voters and that calls the whole country to aspire to something more? That's the challenge I think he has in front of him.
Joshua Hawley, he's author of the new book, Theodore Roosevelt, Preacher of Righteousness. Josh, thanks so much for the work, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
We'll go out with the 1912 He's Coming Back, Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose song. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.